Welcome to episode 51 of the Group Answers Podcast. I'm Brian Daniel, as always, here with Chris Surratt. Chris, what if I told you that you were only one step away from unlocking new levels of maturity and growth in your church? What would you say?
I would say, how much does that cost, and when and where can I get it?
Well, Chris, our guest today, Daniel M., is going to answer that question for us.
That was an amazing intro. I didn't even know that was coming, but wow.
Do we have sound effects going on?
We'll add those in post.
We'll add those in post. Okay, there'll be great explosions. So, Chris, you want to introduce Daniel?
It'll be mostly me just going.
That just happened.
Now, we are excited to have Mr. Daniel M. in the room. He actually works in this building, so it wasn't too far of a walk.
No, three flights of stairs.
Three flights? Awesome. We're glad you took the time just to fill the audience in. This is your second time on the podcast, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
it is.
I wasn't around at that time, so this will be much better, I'm sure. But
well, you're talking about Rick Howerton here.
Oh, this is true.
I mean,
I'm sure Rick is listening.
You can't not like Rick Howerton.
No, everyone loves Rick.
He's group podcast emeritus.
Yes. So Daniel is the director of church multiplication for newchurches.com and Lifeway Christian Resources. And he serves as a teaching pastor at The Fellowship, a multi-site church in Nashville, Tennessee, and also the co-author of Planting Missional Churches. Now, it says co-author, but I mean, seriously, you really were the author, right?
Yeah, so the way Ed and I have now cleared it up, like, he'll say this publicly now. He's like, I wrote the first edition and Daniel wrote the second edition.
Okay.
So he's giving, you know, as time goes by, he's giving me more and more credit for it. But it was a joint project.
Okay. We'll say joint for this room, but we all know.
You got to earn that full credit status with our brother.
Yes, we all know Ed Setzer. But you have an MA in global leadership. And is that the same kind of level as in Canada as it is in America? Or, you know, do you have to, like, get recertified in America?
Well, I got it at Fuller.
Oh, okay. Well, never mind.
So I did get it in the States, yeah.
Good. As you can tell from Daniel's accent, he is not from here, but that's all right. We love him anyway.
Yeah, eh?
Eh? And you can find him at danielm.com. And you also, you've just written a book, and we're going to be talking about that a lot today, called No Silver Bullets.
Yeah.
That's a great book. But before we get into that, I would love for you to just kind of fill us in and the audience on kind of your group's experience, mm-hmm. because I kind of got to know you through social media when you were really kind of big in the small groups world, before you became, you know, before you came to Lifeway. So talk a little bit about how you got here.
Yeah. So right before I came down to Lifeway, and this is actually how I came to Lifeway, the previous church I was at, it was in Edmonton. I grew up in Vancouver, British Columbia up in Canada, but I was pastoring in the Arctic in Edmonton. I mean, the city's like, it's kind of like Houston, Dallas, you know, oil city, northernmost populous city in Canada. It's about 1 million people there, but our church was about 3,000-4,000 people. And I initially went to lead the group's ministry there, right? So think about an established attractional church, you know, time everything down, do the big Christmas music play. That was kind of that setting there where I entered in. And really, in terms of the group space, the church had grown 20 to 30% every year for the last 10 years, but the group's attendance had remained stagnant, 0% growth. And, you know, I mean, what is that? I mean, it was about 1,000 people in group life over 10 years.
That's surprising.
Yeah. So, I mean, in light of all that, it was, you know, I came with the mission of actually one of the operations pastor was like, we are looking for you to find the silver bullet to break the glass ceiling and for us to get 100% in group attendance.
But there are no silver bullets.
He used that word. He used those words.
He did. He actually
did. You are not kidding.
I'm not kidding. And I was like, you know, naively, I was like, yeah, of course we'll do that. Anyway, so I basically started trying everything under the sun to try to just bring about new life. The guy right before me, he was like on this big, you know, he was talking about multiplication, and a ton of groups went rogue. Because it just, you know, and the ones
imagine
that. I know. And then the ones that did multiply, you know, one survived and the other died. And so that was what I walked into. So I couldn't really champion the multiplication piece just because it was so fresh on the ears of everyone. So I really was trying to, hey, how do we just increase assimilation? Because we did some surveys where we would have about 1,000 new people enter our doors every single year. Hmm. right? So our church was growing, our back door was wide open, and there, but people weren't getting plugged in. So after trying a ton of different things, a group of ours went over to England to go to the HTB, like the Holy Trinity Brompton Alpha Conference, like the international one that they do. And they were doing these 20 to 50 person sized environments. Anyways, we brought it back and was trying to find, hey, is there anyone else in North America doing this? A few were doing it here or there. Some were doing it kind of like as church. Others were doing it as missional community or as kind of a midweek service. So not really anything that we really wanted to adopt because we didn't want to blow everything up. Anyways, long story short, we grew that from, zero people to about 700 people in 2 years, you know, in mid-sized communities. And the majority of the people in those mid-sized communities were brand new people, not engaged, not in group life. And what was neat is not only did it help with church assimilation, but it helped with getting them, you know, to be missional. And we didn't blow up small groups because small groups actually met in the off weeks when the mid-sized communities, you know, when the large group gatherings wouldn't meet. So basically that's kind of, you know, I talked to Rick Howerton about that, you know, about 3 years ago, close to 4 years ago now, and he brought me down. And that's kind of what my introduction to Lifeway was.
What's funny is a few years ago, I guess it was about 6 years ago, I also came across mid-sized communities with a model in Sheffield, England.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
And brought it back and started experimenting with it at the church I was at and saw some great success with it. And I was excited about it and started talking to Rick Howerton a little bit and some of the guys here at Lifeway, in particular David Francis, about it. And, you know, I discovered this new way to get people into groups, mid-sized communities. And he let me talk for a while. And then he said, you know, that's basically Sunday school.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, yeah, you're right. It kind of is. So.
So they were off campus? They were on campus?
Actually, my largest mid-sized community was on campus.
Okay.
It wasn't during a service, but it was on campus. Okay. Just because of space needs. It's hard to find a home that's large enough to do a large mid-sized community. And really, when I say mid-sized, that community grew to almost 200, community. So it became a small church or actually a
was
large
Was it every
church.
Other so week different. Like Daniel's? Daniel's was every other week, right?
In homes. We didn't do any at the building.
We had some that were every other week. This one was every week. So a little bit different type of model, but we were able to develop coaches and a whole kind of system within a system with our mid-sized communities, which provided, you know, room for people who wouldn't just jump into a small group in a house, kind of for them to feel a little bit more comfortable.
So Daniel, is the church in Edmonton still using the mid-sized groups?
Yeah, they are. What was interesting is there was a dual purpose to it, right? On the one side, it was fantastic assimilation-wise. And it worked best when we basically didn't allow people to join small groups directly anymore. Because you know how the whole online, you know, call the church is basically a matchmaker. Here's a bunch of groups that you can join. I mean, it's tough to do. It's tough to scale that, right? It's tough. And obviously, we know that people are most apt to connect into a group when they're personally invited by someone in the group rather than, you know, the church secretary saying, oh, this is the best group for you to join. So it was really neat to see the number of people that would get plugged into a group just directly. Because you now had, instead of 8 people or 12 people in a small group inviting, you had like 20 to 50 now inviting other people into the group. So they're continuing to do it, and that is a great way to get people plugged in. Where they've lost the edge, and I've talked to them several times about this, is on the missional side and on really allowing that to be a place for mission to happen. So
we'll get to the micro shifts in just a minute, but I want to ask you just as a follow-up to that question, how did you resource those mid-sized groups, and what was the format of any given meeting?
Yeah, so the format, if we start with that, there are 3 different ways that a typical gathering could happen. The one that we recommended most was, hey, in a home, have a meal, and the whole idea with that social space, you know, going back to Edward T. Hall's proximic stuff, Joseph Meyer's Search to Belong, you know, that social space, that medium-sized space, it was this idea of, hey, let's have a meal so people can connect and figure out who they can go deeper with. Let's also have like a 5 to 10 minute TED talk. So we're allowing people to grow in their teaching gift, because that was one of the biggest gaps that we find in churches. You know, how if someone has a spiritual gift of teaching or has that ability, how many people can you actually place in that role, you know, scalability wise. So they would teach that, and then there, you know, everyone would break up into groups of 3 to 6 people in the home to actually discuss the what was just taught. So in all of those environments, the idea was, hey, this is a place where it's small enough, you're bound to find someone you connect with, large enough that you're not the center of attention when you're new, right? And then you actually have these strategic environments over food and over discussion to find those people you most connect with so that you can begin small groups, smaller groups, more discipleship-oriented groups in the off weeks.
I think sometimes the danger with mid-sized communities is that they can easily turn into ministries.
Yeah.
You can have a mid-sized community that starts out missional, and I've seen this happen. And then, you know, the power of numbers when you have somebody, especially if they have a gift of teaching or are charismatic, and they can quickly turn that into a ministry. And that may not be a bad thing, but, you know, it depends on kind of the end goal of a mid-sized community. For us, it was getting people into small groups.
Yeah.
But, you know, did you see some of that where it would tend, you know, it could become a singles ministry or, you know, whatever?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was interesting in light of that, because it definitely did have that capability. I think the fact that we had it in homes prevented it from ever getting larger roster-wise than 50 people. Because on average, it's not like you had mansions, right? But so I mean, even if a house was maybe at least 1,300 square feet, 1,400 square feet, they could handle a mid-sized community of 20 to 50 people. Because in the end, you're not going to have all 50 people ever come out at one time. Right, the whole paradigm shift was, do they feel like they belong? Do they feel in community, rather than basing that on every single time you meet their gathering, right? Because that's not going to happen. So it was interesting just to, you know, maybe the building, the home was a limit to that, but we definitely saw some groups that were heavily, you know, one leader driven, even though we said, hey, a mid-sized community has to be led by three to six people. Some were very much, hey, here's the alpha leader that's doing everything. But others were more rounded off that way.
What'd you call them?
Oh, we called them MSCs because MSG is bad. We don't want to call them mid-sized groups.
What about you, Chris? What did you call when you
We called them mid-sized communities. Our groups were community groups, so it kind of fit to say mid-sized community.
And that got it done. Okay.
Yeah, mid-sized community. That's true.
All right. So no silver bullets. Just as a precursor here. I don't necessarily believe in the silver bullet, but Chris, Daniel, I desperately want it to be true. I will say that. But in the
we all do.
Yeah.
But in this book, the title is No Silver Bullet. So Daniel, it appears that you're just calling it. You're just making it a matter of record for people like
just
me.
Just dropping the mic.
Hold out hope. I'm holding out hope for the silver bullet. Just saying, not gonna happen. So, what inspired you to write this book?
So it was really in that birth of trying to crack that nut and find the silver bullet at my previous church. Really, that's kind of what it was. It was just trying to figure out, okay, you know, so going to read as many books as I could and look at cutting edge, you know, innovative churches that were trying to figure out the silver bullet to group ministry and all this. And obviously you'd hear guys like, you know, obviously like Steve Gladden at Saddleback, and he's like, oh, 120% of our people are in groups. And, you know, even after hearing that, it's kind of demoralizing.
That's how conferences are. They can be demoralizing.
Yeah. And I'm like, I don't think I could ever do that. I mean, even if I just grow from 30% to 40%, that would be amazing. So in just trying so many different things. And even if you look at our culture today, right? I mean, think about it. You want a book, you can download it. If you want, I mean, with Amazon Prime, like I needed to order something, I could get it today, right? Even Costco does like 1 hour shipping now. Like it's insane the world that we live in. And what's interesting is that has actually seeped into not only our spirituality, right? In the way that we approach God and we ignore, and it's hard for us to discern timing. So this is one thing as I've pastored that I've really noticed over the years. When someone's discerning and asking God of something, if they hear an answer or sense a direction, they automatically think it's now, right? Even though it's scripturally wise, just because, I mean, David didn't become king right away. Abraham didn't. Paul. I mean, right? I mean, so timing is a factor that so many of us have now kind of ignored or don't look at anymore because of this instant gratification culture. So if there's no silver bullet in life, I mean, there definitely isn't one in ministry as we likely know, and as your listeners likely know from the amount of the number of conference books you might have that you never turn to again. Right? I mean, feel bad throwing it out, but.
Yeah, I run into a lot of churches that I think have discipleship whiplash because they just keep jumping on to the next book or the next wagon or whatever that is. It seems to get them to where they need to go. And I think this is a timely message, especially for when we're recording this and probably when you're listening for this, because we're about to hit kind of that season, that January, February season when churches are looking for that next whatever to grow, to get more people discipled, to go from 30% to 90% in groups, you know, by March 1st. Yeah. And so I think this is a timely message for churches. And I'd love for you to kind of give maybe a specific example of how you've seen some of these micro shifts work in your ministry when it comes to groups and discipleship. How has it worked for you?
Yeah. So if you take a look at chapter 2, which is just this whole idea of shifting from a output goals to an input goals approach to ministry, I mean, that is such a game changer in the way that we view maturity, right? Because if you look at the way, so moving from 30% to 90% or closing the back door or whatever the metrics a church might have, right, to say, hey, this is my goal. This is what we want to do. This is what my success is going to be dependent on. If you take a look at that, a lot of times we view goals, and at Lifeway, we focus a lot on lead and lag metrics, right, from the four disciplines of execution. So from that concept, I translated it more into a church context to talk about output and input goals. So in a church context, a lot of times we say, oh, I want to grow it by 40%, my group's ministry by 40%. Right. So what are you going to do differently? Well, I'm going to use a sermon-based study. Right. I'm going to use smallgroup.com. Right. I'm going to use this, you know, and we have all these things that we use. And we're like, hopefully that input that we're doing will result in the output of growing my group's ministry by 50%. But how do you know the one relates to the other? So if you take a look at this, what was interesting, when I was at my previous church, I read about this study that Lifeway Research put out called the Transformational Discipleship Assessment, right? I read the book by Geiger, you know, Philip Nation, and Michael Kelly about it. I read the attributes, the 8 attributes, and I was like, man, that's so good, and I'm so grateful. There's a Canadian sample to that, too, because 30% of it was Canadian. So I was like, this is great, you know, kind of marks the whole Canadian side of, you know, don't ignore us type of thing. And I was like, okay, so what do we do with this? Because I can't remember all 8. Like, even though I read the book, I can't remember all 8. They're really helpful, but how do you actually translate this? So my team and I was leading the adult ministry at our church at that time, and we were trying to figure out how to develop a discipleship pathway and do this. So based on that, you know, the 80-20 rule or keystone habits or vital behaviors, you know, the idea that you can do a couple of things that are going to make a large difference. We're like, what are the one or two things that we could do that are going to produce all 8 of these attributes? Now, I couldn't walk down the hall to go see Lifeway Research. You know, I couldn't call them up or anything like that. So we just kind of did some studying, did some praying, looked through, and we identified a couple. Well, fast forward, I come working here at Lifeway after I finished writing Planting Missional Churches with Ed. I knock on the door of Lifeway Research, and I was like, hey, guys, can I talk to you about this? Is there a connection? Is there something that we can do, one or two things that we can do that are actually going to result in the all 8? And they're like, yeah, it's called regression analysis. And I don't know about you guys, but do you ever hear someone say something like that and you don't want to look like an idiot? So you're like, oh, yeah.
Every day.
Regression analysis.
Every podcast we record.
So I'm like, just so that I know that you know what you're talking about, why don't you explain that to me?
That's the Michael Scott way of doing it.
Yes, exactly. Oh, man, love The Office. so good. So my wife and I are rewatching them. But anyways, that's another note. So we talked about it, and they're like, yeah, we do have that research. We've never written about it. It's not in that book. And I'm like, what are you guys going to do with it? And they're like, we're not going to do anything with it. And I was like, well, can I include that in this book that I'm writing? And they're like, yeah, sure. So that's what kind of ensued the ongoing conversations around that, which I unpack in chapter 2. So here's a really good example, right? If you were to do the input, so that's something you can do. So if those that you're discipling or the group leaders you're coaching or the congregants that you're pastoring, if you're saying, hey, let's confess our sins. And you were to build a habit, right, during the worship service, during, you know, your order of service or small group time, individual, you know, coming to Jesus time, and we were to spend more time confessing our sins, right? What kind of output, what kind of fruit do you think would result if disciples were, you know, more consistent in confessing their sins? What do you guys think? And don't say the answer if you read that part of the book. You know, just off the top of your head. Confession.
No, Chris, what do you think?
Confession leads to...
I read the book, so I'm stuck on that answer.
Yeah.
Are you looking at me?
I'm looking at Brian Daniel right now.
Transformation.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you know, transparency too is something that I commonly hear as well. Or, you know, confession leads to, you know, maybe you're going to obey God, deny self. I'm thinking of the eight attributes in the TDA assessment. So, I mean, all that stuff, it's there, it's true, and we say it because we see it in our lives, right? But what was fascinating in the research is there is actually a correlation, a high correlation between those that confess their sins and individuals then sharing their faith. Mm-hmm. Right? So I presented this, I remember presenting this at one workshop, and a guy was like, literally, he was like, I lead Celebrate Recovery at my church. And the people that have the most junk that they're dealing with, they're actually my greatest evangelists. Right? And then another pastor I shared this with, he went home the next day when he was at Starbucks. I mean, he was like, he spent some time the night before confessing his sins. The next morning at Starbucks, there was one person he evangelized to. Like, and it was just so neat to see how, hey, your understanding of, hey, what happens when you need to confess your sin, you know, what does that then show you about the world? So some of those connections there, I mean, it's so cool to see how that can then be implemented in your church, that connection.
No, that's good. Microshifts, the five that you list are all really, really good, but I want to focus on one specifically for groups. And you kind of hit on this one earlier with your mid-sized communities, mm-hmm. that they shift away from being the missional, you know, the missional side. The chapter five, you talk about from maturity to missionary. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a hard leap for a lot of churches, a lot of group pastors that I talk to, trying to get their groups to break out of that holy huddle, to become missionaries to their community, you know, to be more missional. How would you advise a church pastor to help their groups take that next step, to go from maturity to missionary?
Yeah, so let me, I love this quote here. And I mean, you know, we're all on Twitter, and I love the fact that, I mean, Twitter now, you have 280 characters, so they're not as bite-sized anymore. But before, you know, a lot of people would quote Charles Spurgeon, right? They'd say, every Christian here is either a missionary or an imposter. You know, dash Charles Spurgeon and your characters would run out. Well, if you look at the actual sermon and what he said after that, if we had more characters, which we now do, he actually says right after that, he says, recollect that. Like, that was his version of drop the mic, right? So every Christian here is either a missionary or an imposter. Recollect that. And then he says this. You either try to spread abroad the kingdom of Christ, or else you do not love him at all. It cannot be that there is a high appreciation of Jesus and a totally silent tongue about him. And then he goes on to say in the sermon, that man who says, I believe in Jesus, but does not think enough of Jesus to ever tell another about him by mouth or pen or tract is an imposter. And I share that because a lot of times we think there's a dichotomy between, you know, are you going to be mature or are you going to be a missionary? And sometimes we focus on the maturity side, right? And that's why apologetics has been so huge. It's like, oh, if you want to be a missionary, you got to, you know, come to Christ first. You got to be discipled, and then you got to know all your apologetics, and then you can go and evangelize. But even when you look at the scriptures, right, the Samaritan woman and story after story of and even maybe in your guys' life, but just the idea of, hey, one of the greatest ways that God matures an individual is when they're living on mission with him. So even if you look at desert moments, right, desert moments in the scriptures, desert moments in my life, those are actually some of those moments where we mature the most. But the only reason you got onto that desert moment was because you were on mission. So when you think about it that way, actually, if you look at your group ministry, one of the best ways to disciple someone is to be on mission with them and to show them, you know, instead of just, you know, them going to work and coming home, closing the garage door and, you know, going to their life group or going to church, learn, you know, being on mission is actually one of those things where you're challenged, even your own beliefs, your understanding of the gospel and or your misunderstanding of the gospel becomes so much more apparent when you're living out your faith on a daily basis.
Both of you guys are in and out of a lot of conversations, and Daniel, with your role with leadership, and Chris, just, you know, you're in front of groups all the time. Why is that micro shift so challenging to leaders, group leaders, pastors? I mean, what is it about our culture and our lives that makes that so challenging? Have you uncovered anything?
You know, I heard one pastor say this to me, and I was wrestling with this early on in ministry, and man, he, you know, I was like, well, how do I spend time? You know, I got to do pastoral care. I got to do all this administration stuff for the church, you know, record, you know, all the stuff that I don't want to do. And, you know, you got to prepare your sermon and you just got to do all this stuff, right? And it's like, I don't really have time to spend with, you know, developing relationships with non-Christians. And this one pastor told me, he's like, well, you don't have to. That's not your role anymore. And then when he said that to me, I was like, oh, it just didn't. It didn't sit well, but he just said it so confidently. And I was a couple of years into ministry. I was like, okay, I guess that's what it is. But it just never sat well. And then later on, how does that make sense when you read the scriptures, when you read the gospels? And you're, so what's interesting, I think, is the demands of the ministry, the whirlwind of everything that needs to happen often prevents us from actually spending the necessary time to actually model it in our own lives so that we can have those gospel conversations.
I also think it's the expectation of what it means to be a missionary. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was growing up, the idea was, in the church I grew up in, was you hand out tracts.
Yeah.
That you go, you know, I remember going as a teenager down to the movie theater because movies were evil in the culture I grew up in, even though I snuck out to see them occasionally. My dad hopefully doesn't listen to this, but we would go as a group and we'd stand out there and we'd hand out tracts. Yeah. And that's how you interact with non-Christians, is basically you preach at them.
Yeah.
Where really, you know, I believe wholeheartedly that the most effective way is what you're saying, is that living your life just as a Christian with unbelievers. And,
yeah.
And we all have a life with unbelievers, whether we know it or not, you know, in our workplace or the gym that we go to. And I think that we're not asking people to have a 4-point, you know, Romans Road message ready everywhere they go. You know, it's just, you know, living out the fruit of the Spirit with people in every context that you're in. So you're always a missionary. Your group is always on mission. And so I think it's just flipping some of those expectations that people think when you talk about being a missionary. What does that look like?
And it's those small things, right? And I share a lot of stories about it, right? I mean, the subtitle is 5 Small Shifts That'll Transform Your Ministry. So even yesterday, I had to bring my car into the shop, right? Because it's not starting when it's cold in the morning. So I had to park it there at night. And then I had to bring it in tonight. Anyways, when I was in that moment, Sunday afternoon, when I was trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to get there? How am I going to get home? I was like, do I just Uber? Do I call someone in my life group? And I couldn't do any of that stuff. But I was like, you know what? There's this one guy that I've really been praying for, investing in. He's in my neighborhood that we're friends with, like over the last couple of years, that we've talked a lot about this and you know, about my faith and where we're all at. And I called him up and I was like, hey, it's going to be a 10-minute interaction. It's going to be a 10-minute interaction in the car. But when we would play basketball together, you know, 20, 30 minutes driving back and forth, those are some of the greatest opportunities just to talk and for those conversations to come up. So I gave him a call and he was like, yeah, of course I'll do it. And yeah, our interaction was 10 minutes yesterday. I didn't share the Romans Road with him, but he knows how I live my life. And, you know, I'm just continuing to pray to the Lord, you know, God, please grant me more and more opportunities in the conversation to bring you up and what you're doing in my life.
So Daniel, I think you've already touched on this maybe already, but just for clarity, how can discipleship or a church's group's ministry point people to implement those micro shifts that we've talked about into their groups?
Yeah, so there's a one of the shifts that I talk about is this idea of, I guess this idea of flipping the classroom, right? And it's this idea of, and actually it's interesting because I talk about it in the book when it, as it relates to leadership development. So I'm like, hey, when you're developing leaders, and that's what we built Ministry Grid here at Lifeway around, the idea that you can, hey, here's Steve Gladen teaching on how to lead a small group. For your brand new leaders, you can watch it at home before you get there. And then when you're together in a training environment, you can do coaching, you can do experience. But instead of bringing everyone to a classroom, you can actually do the leadership development at home. So you're flipping it. So that's initially what I talked about. And that's a great way that group leaders can implement that. Now, recently, I've actually been with another platform that Lifeway has, smallgroup.com. I've been using that to flip the classroom in my life group. So what I actually do is we just finished the Explicit Gospel series by Matt Chandler. So all the videos are on smallgroup.com. And what we do is everyone would watch the videos at home, right? We did a Kelly Minter study around that too. And they would watch the video at home. So all of a sudden we now had 30 more minutes together. And it was amazing because before we would eat for 30 minutes, we would watch 30, 40 minutes, and then we'd discuss for 10 and pray for 5 because we just ran out of time. Now we eat for 30, 40 minutes, and we have 50 minutes to discuss and pray, which has been neat because by flipping the classroom in my life group, right, not only is it just people aren't sitting there as lame ducks, right, but we're actually able to get into each other's lives a lot more and a lot deeper. Now, does everyone watch it? You know what? It's interesting. I was a bit hesitant. I was like, are people going to watch it or not? But honestly, out of everyone that's there, about 80% typically watch it before they come. And for those that don't, I mean, they're going to get the point of it. But there's a little bit of shaming that happens at the beginning. not me. Actually, it's interesting because the group has really rallied around it. So I don't even actually ask. When I lead, I don't even actually really ask, has everyone watched it? Because someone else is going to ask. It's fascinating to see that group accountability coming in.
I love that idea. You actually told me about that a few weeks ago. And some of the videos that are out there, like a Tony Evans study, they're like 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And Tony's so amazing that I don't want to shorten that at all.
Yeah.
So I've started using that with groups, telling them, hey, the video is long, so watch it ahead of time.
Yeah.
Then when you get there, you're ready to go. I love that idea.
It serves as devotional as well.
Yeah.
So like it's a different way that you can get into a devotional life, even though it's a video. We're used to that being more, or we've been conditioned to see that as more, entertainment.
Mm.
That can be a part of a devotional life.
Yeah, I mean, even the Beth Moore studies on smallgroup.com, it's like you can't shorten her. Right? No. You got to watch the whole thing.
You got to watch it.
You have, I mean, even there's some.
And they never feel long. Best videos don't feel long to me.
Yeah. And, but the thing is, like, I've had women leaders come up to me and they're like, how do I do this? I really think this will work now with my life group because we just have no time to discuss because the video just takes so long because hers sometimes can go up to like 45 minutes, if not longer, right? So.
All right. In terms of hopes and expectations from No Silver Bullet, so if a church or a group of leaders, if they implemented these microshifts, what would the expectation or hope for 5 years from now?
Yeah, yeah. So this one church recently reached out to me, and the pastor of that church, their entire staff read the first section of the book, right? And the way the first section is broken out is it's a chapter for each shift. The second section of the book talks about how do you now implement that? So how do you introduce change? What are your vision, values, and strategy? And then how do you develop a discipleship pathway? So he just reached out to me and he was like, hey, we're just finishing up the first section. What we're going to do this next year is we're going to identify one of the 5 shifts that we want to implement this year. And we're going to use the second section to do that. And what was really encouraging to me about him sharing that is that very first chapter I talk about this matrix, this influences matrix. And what I share there and what I share in the book is not, hey, here's another model. That's not what I'm talking about. Here's actually, if you remember those old school encyclopedias where you got the human anatomy and you got the transparencies where it's like the skeletal system, the respiratory system, the muscular system, and you see all the. So think about this book in that way, where it's like, hey, here's transparencies that are going to overlay. I'm not trying to change the way that you view or do your programming or discipleship or this or that. I'm trying to give you a new framework to view it all in so that you can see how one thing connects to another thing that connects to another thing. Because sometimes what we are doing as a church that we may think are helping people to grow as disciples could actually be preventing them from being missional, right? So here's the thing, right? Let's say, you know, we want someone in a life group, we want them to serve in you know, in the homeless ministry, we want them to do this, we want them to help out on Sundays, we want them to stack chairs. All of a sudden they're, you know, 5 to 6 hours of their week is consumed with the church, and now you're saying, oh, and now I want you to spend 2 hours a week eating with your non-Christian friends, and they're like, I don't have time to do that. Right? So everything is connected. So what I do with the book and my audits and my templates and my assessments all throughout the book is I help the reader, the church, the staff team, the individual really identify, hey, what can I do next to better develop disciples that are developing disciples that are developing disciples?
So it's a really, I mean, it's a very practical, very hands-on. I like that image. Man, I don't have the best memories from those classes from those years, but I do remember those transparencies of what you're talking about, where you can pull off the different systems of the body. That's a good illustration.
And I think I realized that I pronounced skeletal wrongly.
I don't know. How do you say it, Brian?
Skeletal?
You say skeletal. So maybe it's because I say skeletal.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's what that word was?
I think it was. But I thought, well, I thought it was Daniel's a lot smarter
Supreme
than
Court
I am.
Judge, and I just missed something.
No, it's the enunciation thing. It's interesting.
I love, one of the things I love about the book is that you use a lot of framework and kind of exercises for churches to use. I love the quadrant, the hippie church, the copycat church,
intentional
and silver bullet church. Yeah. I love just thinking through, because I see a lot of those models out there, you know, the copycat where we're going to jump on whatever church is hot right now. Mm-hmm. And then the silver bullet, we're looking for that one thing that's going to get us to 120%.
Yeah.
And you know, and then the kind of organic, everybody's going to grow in their own direction. So we're not going to help them. You know, all of those exist.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
And I think it's helpful just to sit down with your church, your leadership, or your group's team, or whatever it looks like, and kind of think through, okay, are we intentional, or are we trying to look for that silver bullet? Are we copying whatever is out there right now?
Yeah, because if you don't know who you are now or how your church operates today, right, how are you ever going to expect to change? Or see what that, and that's kind of one of those things where you get a brand new church or a brand new pastor coming in or a group's pastor coming in, and they're like, I'm gonna, you know, I'm riding on the I'm riding on the horse, I'm coming in, I'm gonna save the day. But unless you do your homework in discovering, hey, what has happened in the past, you know, and really dig through that, you're never gonna be able to move your church forward. So there's a lot of that's what the assessments and all that stuff is intended for.
Daniel, thanks for being with us. Again, that's No Silver Bullets, 5 Small Shifts That Will Transform Your Ministry. You can follow Daniel at Daniel, S-A-N-G-I, on Twitter, or, of course, DanielM.com that Chris has already referenced. So appreciate you being with us for episode 51. You know, we crossed a landmark with the last show with episode 50. We're at the half-century mark, Chris.
We are. We're on our way to 100.
New beginnings at 51.
We got to do a big celebration when we hit, like, you know, 100.
Well, I thought that was the sound effects earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Daniel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, guys.
We'd like to thank our sponsor, smallgroup.com. Chris, you want to tell us a little bit more? It's come up a couple of times.
Yeah, I don't know that I need to sell it, Daniel. Sold it very, very well. But yeah, it's a database of over 3,000 customizable Bible studies that you can download. It has videos, as Daniel mentioned. You can even have your group watch them ahead of time. You can put all of them on a distribution list or have them kind of pick their own studies if you'd like to do that with your group leaders. But it's a great tool. Check it out. 30-day free trial just by going to smallgroup.com and putting in your name, picking a password, and you're ready to go.
We look forward to being with you again for episode 52. And if you have show ideas or suggestions or topics that you would like for us to address, reach out to us through Twitter. That's at Chris Surratt or at BC Daniel. Until next time, this is Brian Daniel, Chris Surratt, and Daniel Nichols.